Today we are recording this podcast in the Dish with One Spoon territory, as we consider the people who originally owned and took care of this land and the treaties it includes. We also recognize that our listeners are all over the province and are on other important Indigenous lands with their own treaties and unceded territories. As we acknowledge and extend our appreciation to the Mississaugas, the Anishinaabe, and the Haudenosaunee for sharing their land with us, we encourage our listeners to learn more about the Indigenous history and treaties in their own communities as well. We all have obligations to those treaties and to Canada's Indigenous peoples. Welcome to the pod. I'm your host and incoming First Vice President, Charlene Theodore, and you're listening to Holiday Hours, OBA's CPD podcast exclusively offered to OBA members on the go. In this two-part series, I will be talking to the Honorable Justice Robert Sharp about his book, The Lazier Murder, which deals with a murder, trial, and execution that took place in 1884 in Prince Edward County, shaking the otherwise peaceful and thriving United Empire Loyalist settlement. We will also be joined by leading criminal practice expert and associate at Cooper, Sandler, Scheim, and Bergman, Amanda Ross. Together, we'll explore the ethical implications and the lessons the case offers, as well as the professional hazards to avoid in cases where there may be community outrage and a rush to judgment. We'll also explore how professional standards have changed and whether the profession is better able to avoid the issues that lead up to the miscarriage. All right, so welcome, Justice Sharp and Amanda Ross, and thank you so much for joining us for our first ever CPD podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure to be here.
All righty, let's get into it. This story starts in one of my favorite areas of the province, Prince Edward County. On the evening of December 22, 1883, with the murder of Peter Lazier, and ends with Joe Thompson and George Lauder being hanged for that murder. Along the way, we'll cross paths with some of Canada's most famous personalities, including Canada's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, Dalton McCarthy, who would go on to found two of Canada's most prestigious law firms, and Justice Christopher Patterson, who would ultimately sit on Canada's Supreme Court. But before we meet them, let's go back to that night, December 21st, 1883, when Peter Lazier was murdered. Justice Sharp, what happened that night?
Let me start by saying I'm glad you like Prince Edward County.
I love Prince Edward County.
Because I grew up in Prince Edward County.
I heard a rumor.
And that is why I got interested in this case.
Wow.
Because as I was growing up, people would still talk about this case.
Really?
Which struck me as bizarre. So I thought would be interesting to try to figure out why this case still endured in the memory of Prince Edward County. And that's really one of the reasons I wrote the book. So what happened was... On the night of December 21st, Peter Lazier stopped by to stay with his relatives, a Quaker couple, at a place near Bloomfield. Earlier in the day, the Quaker gentleman, Gilbert Jones, had sold a load of hops at the Bloomfield train station, and he'd got paid quite a bit of money, $555, which, hard to translate, but more than 20% more than a tradesman's salary, so quite a lot of money. Around 10 o'clock at night, after everyone had gone to bed, including Peter Lazier, a knock at the door, and there were two men. Mrs. Jones went out to open the door. There were two men standing there. One had a hood over his head. He was holding a pistol. The other one had a shotgun, and he had a beard, or later described as a false beard, but a beard. Mrs. Jones went to get Mr. Lazier to come out to help because her husband had hurt his back earlier in the day. He came out, engaged in a struggle with a man with the shotgun who tried to hit him on the head with the shotgun. That man then fled. Gilbert Jones came out of the bedroom after Mrs. Jones had gone into the bedroom and witnessed the other man shoot two shots, one which hit Peter Lazier in the heart. And that is how the murder occurred.
Wow, an exciting chain of events. After this murder... From what I understand, there really isn't a local police force. So my take on it is that you have community members who are basically acting as amateur detectives and police officers?
That's right. The case is interesting because it happens at a point in our history when we're moving from one model of criminal justice administration to a newer model. The older model was community justice. And so there were local worthies, if you like, who got appointed as constables, unpaid, just get fees for the particular service they performed. And they were sort of responsible for the administration of criminal justice. There was no organized police force in Prince Edward County at this time. It was in the hands of these local people, constables. So what happened was the doctor was immediately summoned from Bloomfield. The doctor happened to be the coroner. And under the practice at the time, an inquest was convened immediately at the scene. The inquest was part of the investigation into crime, not what we think of as a coroner's inquest today at all, but really part of the investigation. He convened the inquest. Now, before he did that, they noticed that there were footprints in the snow. It had snowed that evening, and they noticed footprints around the house. And there was what was called a hue and cry. They got everybody in the neighborhood to come. They all knew that Jones, some of them knew Mr. Lazier, and they were very alarmed, of course, by what they saw and what they witnessed. And they went out into the night with lanterns trying to follow the tracks in the snow. And that was the extent of the investigation until Chief McKinnon emerged from Belleville the next day.
So I'm going to turn to Amanda now. Amanda, have you ever had to deal with a circumstance where community members were involved in the immediate aftermath of a crime?
I think in this day and age, it's becoming increasingly common for community members to be involved. And I don't think it's cynical or paranoid to think that that's because of the advent of the surveillance state. You know, right now we're operating in a society where there are video cameras everywhere, you know, municipally operated, police operated, and everybody is walking around with a video camera in their cell phone. And so it's not unusual for me these days to see a disclosure package and half of the content is movie quality surveillance footage. And so I think especially when we see crimes in that context and also things that occur in the public, you know, people are keen to get involved, they're keen to videotape, they're keen to help.
Everyone's got their cell phones out.
Exactly. Everybody's out and ready to get involved. And so I have seen these kinds of cases where, you know, it's very well-intentioned, but people are all over a crime scene, they're handling, you know, evidence before police get there, they turn it over. And so you have continuity issues, you know, DNA issues, and you have surveillance issues that can be a challenge for the defense in the case of your client. So yeah, I've seen that before.
So if you were retained by Mr. Thompson and Mr. Latterer's defense counsel, and you hear there have been, you know, a bunch of amateurs or maybe, you know, true crime enthusiasts, not police or not what we know today as police, going through the crime scene, what is the first thing you do when that happens?
So it's a very interesting question from the perspective of the defense, and a part of it turns on whether or not your client is innocent or, you know, we can call it less than innocent. Because in the case of an innocent client, you know, you may have a large interest in protecting the crime scene. There may be evidence there that exonerates your client. There may be evidence pointing to another suspect. And so in that case, you want to ensure that it's preserved. So it's not unusual, you know, for example, in this day and age, if you know there's surveillance footage that potentially exonerates your client, you would take independent steps as a lawyer to ensure it's preserved. On the other hand, if your client is, you know, less than innocent, it can often inure to the benefit of the defense to have a crime scene that's been improperly investigated that may be tainted, because there may be an argument for your client down the road that both necessary and exonerating evidence has been lost, and also the trustworthiness of the investigation is in question. So it's a little bit of a difficult proposition depending on what your client has to tell you. But, you know, generally speaking, I think confusion can assist the defense.
Interesting. So let's leave the modern day of cell phones and surveillance, and let's go back to 1883. Justice Sharp, what evidence is accrued at the Lazier crime scene that leads to the arrests?
What happened was this tracking that I mentioned in the night. Many people were involved, including the constable, the local constable, but many of the local residents were involved. And they went out into the night following what they thought were the tracks left by the two assailants. At various points, they lost the track. At various points, the tracks disappeared as the perpetrators walked over glare ice, for example. So at various points, they lost the track. But eventually, they became convinced in their own minds, and I think they were honestly convinced, that they could track two paths, one to the Louder residence, where two of the accused, David Louder and George Louder, lived with their family, and one to the residence of Joseph Thompson, where he lived with his wife and his child. The first person to be arrested was Thompson by one of the constables. They then proceeded to the Louder residence, where they arrested David Louder, not George Louder. He was arrested later the next day.
So 2019, this day and age, one would expect something like this to go to Crown Counsel. They'd review the evidence, make a determination whether or not to prosecute. But we're today talking like we're in 1883, and there really wasn't a Crown Counsel presence in Prince Edward County at that time. Can you take us through the steps that were undertaken to determine whether or not they should even prosecute these two?
The first step I've already mentioned, and that was the coroner's inquest, which started at the Jones residence while Peter Lazier lay there dead. It later, in the next morning, moved to the Bloomfield Town Hall. The coroner conducted an inquest. Witnesses testified. Oddly enough, the accused men were wandering around in the town hall as this all occurred. And people started to get rather upset that they were doing so. And there was even talk of kind of almost like a lynching. And so eventually they removed the accused to the Picton Jail. But the inquest concluded with a finding, not surprisingly, of homicide, but no suspects were named. The preliminary inquiry, what we would call the preliminary inquiry, the committal proceedings, started 6 days later. It shows you how different was their purpose. Their purpose was actually to see, do we have a case against these three people? And that happened, as I say, 6 days later. There was a much more complete airing of the evidence. You're right that there was no permanent Crown attorney, but there was a local lawyer, a very prominent local lawyer, who had been the mayor of the town, a very well-known individual. He acted in cases like this as the Crown attorney. So he led the case for the Crown at the committal proceedings. The accused were all represented by one very young lawyer. He was in his first year of practice, and he did
no
his
pressure.
Best. No pressure, no pressure. He did his best, but that was the only counsel that they had. And at the end of the committal proceedings, which took a day or two, they were committed for trial.
So slightly off topic, but just to satisfy my curiosity, you'd mentioned that the very popular lawyer who was also the mayor served as Crown Counsel, and the doctor was also the coroner. I'm really interested in that coroner piece. Was that the practice because of just the size, Prince Edward County, or was it common in that time that the local doctor would also have this relationship with law enforcement to also be the coroner?
Apparently it was a very sought-after position. I'm not quite sure why. Perhaps it paid a bit. Very sought after, and a lot of people wanted to be the coroner. The fact that he arrived at the scene so quickly was just the coincidence that he was the closest doctor. So they summoned him because he worked in Bloomfield, but he happened to be the local coroner as well, and he did then assume the duties, his legal duties as coroner.
And the mayor, lawyer, slash Crown, is that again a common practice at that time? Is there just one lawyer that gets assigned these cases on behalf of the Crown? Or is it, do you have a series of people that you choose per case?
Apparently, he had a kind of a permanent retainer.
He had the gig.
As the Crown attorney. When we come to the trial, we'll see later that he would not take the trial. So it was a very different idea than we have now. But he did deal with the committal proceedings. He did deal with the retention of counsel for the trial and the other preliminary matters. And I think, we're talking about a very early stage in our history. There were not that many lawyers. There were not that many doctors.
Yeah.
And so it's not surprising that the local lawyer
Everybody
would also
had
be
multitask.
The mayor and also be the Crown attorney.
Yes.
I mean, you go to small communities today, the same pattern
applies.
Might well emerge.
So it seems fair at this point to say that the community reaction played a fairly substantial role in the determination that the prosecution would proceed.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. This event seriously unsettled Prince Edward County. It was a quiet place, fairly remote, peaceful, prosperous at this time because of the barley and hops.
Agriculture. Farming, yeah.
It was called the barley days.
Oh, really?
And it's sort of like now we have the wine days in Prince Edward County.
Yes.
Well, the barley days preceded that period of enormous prosperity. And Peter Lazier had come from the county. He lived at the time in Belleville, but he come from the county. He was known to people. He was a United Empire loyalist, which was a mark of great distinction at this time in Prince Edward County. The heart and soul, if you like, of the originators of the county, original European settlers to the county. And so it was a shocking event, and it unsettled people. And the community at first, for sure, was out for blood. They were outraged. They thought this was a clear case of guilt, and they wanted these people to hang.
It's funny, you know, we're trying to bring people's mindset back to 1883, 1884, but anybody who's taken a trip up to Prince Edward County, you know, anytime within the last 10 years knows it's kind of still the same. It's not barley, it's wine, it's, you know, local farmers and sandbanks and lots of families. And it's kind of this little bubble where people go to get away of the hustle and bustle of the city. So if something like that were to happen today, if you picked up the paper tomorrow and saw this kind of headline about this kind of crime in Prince Edward County, I think our feelings would be just as similar now as they would have been in 1883.
I think you're probably right. There is a strong sense of community in Prince, and there always has been in Prince Edward County. And it's partly geography because it is cut off from the rest of the province. So it's almost like an island mentality and a sense of being a distinctive place, character of its own, culture of its own, and its own people.
Yeah, the one thing I noticed about Prince Edward County, even though it's quote-unquote rural, the homes are still really close together with small streets. So it's in this kind of rural setting, but people are still physically very close to each other.
And many of those lovely old homes that you see were built in the barley days. They were built on hops and barley money.
You need a lot more than hops and barley money today to be able to afford them, but that's not the point of this podcast. So I wanted to ask you, Amanda, about walking into a situation, as one often does in today's social media environment, where there is already a lot of noise on social media and traditional media about the accused. And to some extent, the perception is that the public has already made a determination about the accused's guilt. What do? You just ignore that noise, or how do you actually deal with it on the ground?
Well, you absolutely can't ignore it. And I think the point about the outrage in a small community or any community when this type of violent, unexplained crime happens is a very important one. You know, people are understandably afraid, they're understandably outraged, and there's this immense pressure, I would assume, on the part of the police to find out who did it and to keep the community safe. And so that amount of community outrage I can completely appreciate. And the challenge coming from the defense perspective is how to separate that completely understandable outrage from the sense that your client is convicted before he or she has ever had a trial. And so I think as a defense lawyer, you do have to try to take control of that at the outset. And you have to appreciate, you know, in a human way, juries and jurists are all human. You know, they are supposed to be immune. You know, we expect them to be immune in a way that, you know, realistically they can't be from the perspective of the media and from outside sources. But at the end of the day, we have to acknowledge that there can be an impact on that. And so whether that's in a very high-profile case, making an application to change the venue of where your client's trial will be because in their own community they can't get a fair trial, that may be something to pursue. And in extremely publicized cases, it may be necessary with your client to engage with the media before a trial to ensure that there is another perspective, the perspective of innocence that's also being portrayed, because you can't afford oftentimes to let your client get snowed under by the sentiment of the community.
I like that. Appreciate that point you made about, from the community perspective, there is a very real need for people to feel safe, right, while the process of the justice process plays out. I'm wondering, in this day and age with social media, I guess it's my opinion that we're not just dealing with small communities anymore. When it comes to social media and things of that nature, even if a crime took place in Calgary and I live in Toronto, I may not fear for my safety, but there's a way through social media that all Canadians can feel invested in the outcome of a proceeding. And what is it that you can do to, you can't avoid it, but how do you manage that? Is it just that engagement with the media that you're referring to?
So it's difficult. You know, I've had cases where a client of mine who is a relatively well-known individual, he gets charged the second you Google his name, the first thing that comes up is an article about him on this gossip website called The Dirty. Ugh. You know, disparaging him. You've heard of it. Yeah. So disparaging him, you know, asserting his guilt, you know, saying the most atrocious things about him. It's very difficult to manage that because that's coming from an anonymous source. We can't control it. You can attempt to get it removed, but it's very difficult to do and risks inflaming whoever did it to make them move further. And I've also seen Reddit threads about my clients where, you know, armchair detectives in the community are, you know, posing theories, they're discussing evidence, they're discussing the witnesses in the case. That's very hard to moderate. And so, you know, it's kind of a judgment call and a strategic call about whether you address it head on or whether you more generally take an approach with your client where in the media you're asserting your innocence, you're saying we're waiting for the trial and we trust the judgment of the jury, of the jurist at the end of the day to come to a fair decision. But it is challenging to make that determination.
Those are some really insightful points about the social media aspect. We're going to do a deep dive into the social media aspects in episode 2. I think it speaks to the strength of the writing and the enduring themes that the book evokes, that I could read a book about a crime in 1884 and not get the Charles Smith scandal off my mind. I never thought I would connect those two. I'd love to for you to chat with us a little bit about Hugh McKinnon and the role that he plays.
Well, Hugh McKinnon was at the time the chief of police in Belleville, which is a city not far from about 20 miles from where this crime occurred. And he is the sign of what's coming in the administration of criminal justice. Some of it's good and some of it's bad. What's good about it is it's a more professional approach. And he was or purported to be a professional policeman. And he'd come in and restored the police force in Belleville to something like a credible police force. It's a shift away from the community-based justice model that I mentioned before with local unpaid constables to a much more professional approach. When the province was thinking of introducing a more professional policing system in Ontario generally, they asked people what they thought. And most of Ontario said, yes, we need that. But it's interesting, Prince Edward County, the local sheriff, the local judge said, no, we don't need that. We're quite fine. But when it came down to a serious crime, like the one they had to confront in the Lazier case, they were only too happy to have Hugh McKinnon come across and take charge of the investigation. So he wanted to establish his reputation as a crime buster. He was a very aggressive, ambitious man, a very large man, imposing man, and he saw his opportunity with the Lazier case.
I guess it's a combination of genuine community need and some mixed with some self-interest on McKinnon's part.
Some unfortunate aspects to his personality, yes.
Justice Sharp, the defense counsel in this case is Dalton McCarthy, who is, immortalized today on the McCarthy Tetrow firm name. Can you tell us a bit about him and how he deals with all of the issues thrown at him when he's retained as defense counsel?
Well, he was an outstanding trial lawyer in particular, although he argued many of the big constitutional cases of the day in the Privy Council. So he had a reputation both at the appellate and at the trial level. He was said to be one of Canada's best jury lawyers. He was a politician. He served in Ottawa as an MP and had done so for some time, continued to do so after this case. He was seen as a potentially significant figure in the Conservative Party of Sir John A. Macdonald, but for one fatal flaw that he had, and that was that he was rather virulently anti-French and anti-Catholic. It didn't fit the Conservative Party's model or the Canadian model at the time. So that kind of spelt an end to his political career at a high level, but certainly as a lawyer, he was outstanding. He was retained late in the day. In fact, he did not arrive until after the first day of trial, when some very critical evidence had been introduced. So he was at a bit of a disadvantage. He obviously did not have a lot of time to prepare for this case, but he did, a very credible job, a very strong job. In terms of the public opinion, he, throughout the case, made the point of saying, look, you've got to try this case on the evidence. It was particularly strong in his closing jury address. I trust you to be fair-minded and decide the case on the evidence, not on the public mood in this community, because the public mood was very obvious. I could find no suggestion that anyone considered a change of venue. I don't know how common that was at the time. I think it was legally possible. This may be partly because of the fact the accused were represented right up to trial by this very young and inexperienced lawyer. It may be a fact that they didn't have the resources to resort to such means.
Because they would have had to bear the cost.
Yes, but there's no suggestion about a change of venue. I would have thought this was a case that might call for one had one been sought, but it was not sought.
And I imagine that if you're in Prince Edward County and you seek a change of venue, you know, in a car or on a plane, or a short, you know, short plane ride, the change of venue isn't far, but the actual limits of transportation at the time may have factored into that as well.
The practicalities may have been difficult to overcome. I'm not sure. But I could find no reference to any attempt or any thought given to it.
So, Amanda, talk to me about how you would deal with an expert like McKinnon in this day and age. A Crown expert where you feel as though they're really not acting the way that they are expected to and really going beyond the scope of their professionalism or what they're charged to do.
Well, Justice Sharp had identified this issue in his book about Hugh McKinnon potentially being a victim of noble cause corruption. You know, it's in reading the book, it's very clear to me that this officer really thought that he was prosecuting the right people. You know, he's going for the evidence, he wants to prove them guilty, and he believes them to be guilty. But there is a sense of him being willing to, you know, circumvent the rules a little bit, you know, kind of flout what maybe he should be doing in order to try to secure that outcome. So when you have that combined with the very dangerous weight that we see expert evidence potentially given in the court, you're looking at a recipe for disaster. And so in this case, for example, you know, we've heard that McKinnon didn't even follow the established practice at the time for taking footprint evidence. You know, he's not going by his own prescribed standards or the standards of the time, and that's a dangerous thing. So I think in any case, when you're looking at expert evidence, you know, now we're applying the contemporary standards, we're looking at Mohan and Abbey and White Burgess, you know, you're looking at factors including the potential bias of an expert and their own qualifications. So in a case like this, I would always want to seek the CV of the expert. I'd want to look at the materials that the expert relies upon. I'd want to look at the accepted standards and see if the expert had followed those guidelines when doing his own assessment. And I'd also want to take a look at the potential bias. You know, call the expert and ask them about the weaknesses in their own opinion. Are they willing to speak with you? Because if they're not, that can inform the bias argument and their impartiality. And that's one of the prongs in the admissibility test. You know, it goes to beyond weight, it's admissibility as well, as to whether this expert's even allowed to testify. So for me, you know, McKinnon both didn't follow the rules, and also he had a clear bias towards the accused in this case. I don't think his evidence should have ever been admitted.
So there were some real bombshells, I guess today they would be called tabloid moments, that came up during the trial. Do you want to talk a little about that, Justice Sharp?
There were two or three points in the trial where the Crown sprung surprise evidence on the defense, and it obviously shook McCarthy, took him totally by surprise. He didn't know how to handle it. One witness testified that some months earlier he had seen Joseph Thompson with a pistol. This had never been disclosed to the defense, and McCarthy didn't know it was coming. Another witness appears to have romantic attachment to Thompson, and disappointed romantic attachment to Thompson. And she testified that he had told her how easy it would be to go and rob that farmer Jones of all his money. McCarthy didn't know that was coming. Thompson didn't know that was coming, and they did not handle it well. So now we, of course, have disclosure, mandatory disclosure, that would never be permitted, but it was permitted at the time.
So given the combination of these larger-than-life characters and questionable policing, let's talk a little bit more about how the trial unfolds.
The trial was a major event in the life of Prince Edward County, so there was a huge throng of people to see the trial. Justice Patterson came on assizes to try the case. As I mentioned, the case started without Dalton McCarthy or the other lawyer retained to defend the Louders, George Dixon from Belleville. They came a day late. I assume that the young lawyer in Picton who was defending all three realized he was out of his depth, but I assume there was a problem getting retainers too. There's no doubt that Dalton McCarthy got a substantial fee for this case because I found records of correspondence between him and Sir John A. Macdonald offering him a position as Minister of Justice, and McCarthy said, I can't afford to do that. This was just shortly before this case. I can't afford to do that because I'm in debt. He'd suffered reversals as a result of a bad investment.
Okay.
So he didn't come down from Ottawa for nothing.
Okay.
So somebody came up with the money.
Someone made it worth his while.
So the case got underway as crucial evidence was given in day one that McCarthy and Dixon were not there to cross-examine on, which was, I think, regrettable. The case unfolded over about 6 days. that Justice Patterson was determined to get it done in a week, so he would start early. He sometimes would finish quite late, 6:30, 7 o'clock at night. Interesting to read the transcript, because although so much is different today, the transcript actually reads not unlike a transcript from today. So the basic model of the trial proceeded much the way it would today. One major difference is at this time, accused persons could not testify on their own behalf. So even though the Louders and Thompson proclaimed their innocence, they were not allowed to testify. And so we never heard their story. The jury never heard their story in court. They presented an alibi evidence. The Crown's evidence was essentially the tracking evidence that I've mentioned. A few other things. They sprung a couple of surprises, which we might want to talk about, on the defense during the case. The alibi evidence was somewhat shaky, but it was there. And at the end of the case, Justice Patterson, actually not quite at the end of the case, he directed a verdict of acquittal in favor of David Louder. There really was no evidence against him. His feet were the wrong size for the footprints. There was no question of him being convicted, but he gave a jury charge, and the jury deliberated for a relatively short space of time and convicted. I would say the one thing that was highly regrettable about the way the trial proceeded was the behavior of the audience. Justice Patterson had to clear the courtroom a number of times. Essentially, when prosecution made a good point, the crowd would clap. When McCarthy or Dixon scored a point in cross-examination, the crowd would hoot and deride them for challenging what they thought was unassailable evidence.
Now, was this particular to this case or other cases that inflamed the passions of the community at the time? Or, you know, was this just the kind of the things that were permissible in the 1880s?
I don't think anybody regarded this as permissible. The judge was certainly upset about it. Another local lawyer named Edwards Merrill, who was actually the mayor of the town at the time, sat through the case and later wrote a letter to Sir John A. Macdonald, because he was a conservative as well, and said that it was disgraceful, the behavior of the crowd. So the reaction of contemporary people, certainly Dalton McCarthy's reaction of contemporary people suggests that this, even at that time, was unusual and unacceptable.
I want to talk a little bit more about Justice Patterson, who eventually goes on to sit on Canada's Supreme Court. Is there anything else that you found notable about the way he handled the trial?
I would say it was fairly standard way he handled the trial. He might have done more about the unruly crowd. I'm not sure what he could have done, but he might have done more.
Other than clearing the courtroom.
Courtroom or maybe keeping it cleared. Interestingly, he knew Picton very well, because he was born in England, came to Picton when he came to Canada at the age of about 21, and articled with the local lawyer who was the Crown attorney. And so he knew the community, he understood the community, practiced there for several years before moving to Toronto, where he became a well-recognized lawyer, ultimately appointed to what was then called the Court of Error and Appeal.
So you really might say there probably was no one better suited to manage that courtroom in the state the community was in, and even with all of his kind of ties to the community and knowledge of the community. There was still a lot of chaos within the proceedings themselves.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly knew the community and would have understood the community. Mm-hmm. And he was a judge with a strong reputation.
And I think tried his best.
He tried what he could.
So the community obviously thought this was a done deal, open and shut case. But there were some holes in the Crown's case. Can we talk a little about that, Justice Sharp?
Well, it was never clear how the assailants got to the Jones farmhouse. They just appeared there. We don't know how they got there. The other thing is that the Crown's theory broke down as to who played what role in this crime. The tracking evidence that they had Thompson as the shooter, yet the shooter was the person with the dark beard, and Thompson had a dark beard. So Hugh McKinnon, I think, got Mrs. Jones to say that, as she said at the committal, that he had a dark beard. By the time of the trial, was a phony, false dark beard. So there were some holes in the case like that. The man who did the shooting ran off. Gilbert Jones, the farmer, saw him run off, and he had a very distinctive limp. There was no evidence that either of these men had a limp. The man who did the shooting appeared to be left-handed. No evidence that either of these men were left-handed. Nor was there any evidence that they weren't left-handed. So both the prosecution left a hole, and the defense, I suspect because they weren't properly prepared,
didn't
exploit potentially devastating holes in the Crown's case.
Wow. And that certainly sounds consistent with Hugh McKinnon's character. So after the trial, but before the execution, there's a belief that begins to kind of bubble up that these gentlemen weren't actually guilty. What steps were taken in an attempt to review or reverse the verdict?
Well, that's a very interesting question from a variety of angles. The first thing, I've mentioned one major change in criminal justice, the fact that the accused could not testify at the time. The second major difference is there was no appeal. So there was no way to go to the Court of Appeal to challenge what had occurred at the trial. The way it worked was that the cabinet would review any capital verdict, any capital case, punishment of death, would be reviewed at the cabinet level. So there was a petition to the cabinet. That was the formal legal way that cases were reviewed. They weren't reviewed so much the way we review them today. We Court of Appeal looks to see if there's a legal error. That isn't what the exercise was about. It's more about, is this a case where something went wrong and we should exercise some kind of clemency? Is this the case where the law is operating in an unduly harsh manner? It's sort of a clemency, mercy type function that the cabinet exercised.
As opposed to a
legal review for error that we conduct by the Court of Appeal. So you describe what I call kind of a shift in the mood of the community. And I think what happened was that the unruly element was clearly, they were not the elite of Prince Edward County. These were the ordinary working people. There's a strong flavor in the letters that were written and the petitions that were drafted that these were the product of the more sophisticated, the more educated, the more upstanding members of the community. That was the way they pitched it, if you like, to the government. So I mentioned Edwards Merrill, the local mayor. He wrote a letter. A couple of ministers, clergymen, wrote a letter. A former member of parliament got behind the campaign to have these people have their conviction looked at. So that was kind of the flavor, that the more upstanding, right-thinking members of this community almost are embarrassed by what happened by this unruly mob.
I'm just curious about this. Do you think it was just the passage of time and things eventually calming down in their natural course that allowed people to say, well, now it's safer for me to step up and intervene? Or, you know, had the mob kept up or the passions just kept at a high level throughout, do you think that things may have turned out differently and no one would have intervened?
It's an interesting question.
I ask that because I think that there is important consideration to the class distinction of people who intervened. And sometimes the way I imagine it is there's an angry mob, they're of a certain class, and it's not about the injustice, I must get involved. It's also like a political classist thing saying, you know, do I want to attach my name to this?
The odd thing about the class division in this case is it doesn't sort of go the way you'd expect, because Lazier and the, you know, the barley and hops business that Mr. Jones was in, that was the fancy people. That was the well-to-do people.
Yeah.
And it was some of the underclass who were alleged to have committed the crime. And yet it's the underclass that rise very strongly up in condemning those people, and the more sophisticated element, the upper crust of the community, that rises to defend them. So it's kind of counterintuitive the way the class divide worked in this way, but there's no doubt there was a strong class divide here.
So there's absolutely an element of classism kind of politics playing into it, but maybe not in the way that you would expect.
And, you know, when Edwards Merrill, the mayor, wrote a letter to Sir John A. Macdonald and talked about the public opinion, John A. Macdonald is a politician.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, the temptation not to reverse a jury verdict and go against popular opinion would not have been very strong on his part.
Which brings even, a little more nuance into the quote-unquote appeal, existing exactly. appeal standard as a clemency, mercy thing and not on law. It's more about, there has to be some self-interest involved from the politicians that are reviewing these decisions.
There's a political element, definitely a political element.
1883, crazy times. So again, back to 2019, there is much more. Our focus on wrongful convictions has only amplified as the law has evolved. I decided I wanted to be a lawyer when I was, 14 or 16, and I got a copy of the Stephen Trescott story from a garage sale. There's also the Donald Marshall case and inquiry. I went to law school at Dalhousie, and so I'm very familiar with that. And now we've got podcasts and documentary series and Netflix series. I think it's fair to say around the table that if this fact scenario were to play out today, it would definitely be the subject of, a serial type podcast or a Making a Murderer type Netflix series. Amanda, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about modern day wrongful convictions and that landscape in your practice. Does this focus of this as kind of like a community subgenre and a subgenre of entertainment, does it add another dimension to your work as defense counsel?
I think it does. The prospect of a wrongful conviction is just terrifying and heartbreaking for a criminal lawyer. So to hearken back to a point that Justice Sharp made, the public reaction to this case, back in 1883, within the courtroom, the public reacting so strongly to the prosecution and the defense, it's something that wasn't acceptable at the time and wouldn't be acceptable now. And so in a typical courtroom during a trial, I'm not getting an onslaught of boos, from the body of the court. In a literal sense, but sometimes it sure feels like it. Being a defense lawyer can be a pretty thankless go, and especially when you're defending a person who's charged with something that's pretty objectively deplorable, and you feel the weight of the state very strongly on you in those cases, especially if you think your client is innocent. And I think most criminal lawyers have different coping mechanisms for how they cope with doing these types of difficult cases. I tend to get very invested in mine, and at the end of a case, I fully believe my client, and I'm very concerned about my client's innocence. And so if something goes wrong, whether it's because I think I did something wrong or because the decision just came back in a way that I think
is...
Did
it go your way?
Yeah, and even worse, if it comes back and I think that's just wholly unjust, that is really devastating for me, and I think it's devastating for the administration of justice. So I think it's something that lawyers take very seriously, and especially with the advent of Serial and Making a Murder and the Staircase, all of these wonderful documentaries and podcasts, it's a good thing that this is in the public, perception, in an increased way, because I think these issues are very important.
It's funny, we were having a chat before this podcast began about true crime as entertainment. It definitely has become its own genre, right? Whether it's movies, whether it's documentaries or podcasts. I guess we're having the debate is it raising awareness, or is it maybe even not trivializing it, but is it making to see people who are the subject of these things as just kind of characters in a drama and not like this is the things that are happening to real people?
Well, exactly. And I think for most people who get charged with a crime, regardless of the outcome, their hope at the end of the day is never to be the poster child for a wrongful conviction. You don't want your identity for the rest of your life to be tied to a Google search about this thing that you never did, even if ultimately you're vindicated. So I think there is a risk of turning people into the worst thing that they're ever alleged to have done, of that consuming your identity.
Their life being reduced to one night or one
month. Exactly, and I think that's just desperately unfair. On the other hand, I think that public weight carries a lot of power, and so if there is a public interest in seeing cases reopened, that can be something that's very helpful potentially to a person who's been wrongfully convicted. There are remedies available to us today that weren't available to these men at the time. There's an appeal to the Supreme Court. If the appeal to the Court of Appeal doesn't go your way, potentially. There's also an application under Section 696.1 of the Criminal Code to the Minister of Justice to reevaluate the case on the basis of a miscarriage of justice. And that's something that wasn't available at the time.
The other thing that's happened, and it's a very positive thing, is that we now accept the possibility of wrongful conviction.
Yeah.
It's very interesting when you look at the record in this case. They just didn't think it could happen. If the jury convicted, they must be guilty. And there was no sense that this wonderful system we've created, our adversary system, our jury trial system, could produce an injustice. And I think that's one major piece of progress we have made. that we now accept that things go badly wrong.
It's within the realm of possibility.
And it's within the realm of possibility, yeah. And we better be very, very careful about it. We've identified some of the markers that enable us to identify wrongful convictions. So that's some significant progress.
So, Amanda, you referred earlier to how devastating it is if you know that there has been a wrong, the decision's gone against a client that you believe is innocent. So if you're in that scenario, your client's been found guilty, you've exhausted all appeals, but they are still maintaining their innocence. What are your professional obligations as a lawyer? What can or should you do next?
So I think it's a situation where you have to completely let go of your own ego and invite somebody else in to take a look at the case. Because, you know, worst case scenario, maybe I did something wrong. You know, I left a stone unturned, I took a wrong path. And I'd want my client to have the ability to have somebody else come in, take a look at it, and say, your lawyer did wrong by you, and you should have a remedy because of that. You know, you can also pursue other forms of investigation. As technology improves, people have been exonerated because improvements in DNA technology.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's a case of re-examining the existing evidence to see if we can turn up something now that just wasn't possible back at the time that the evidence first came into existence. I talked a little bit about the application to the Minister of Justice, and that's one potential avenue, but that generally depends on new evidence coming to light. So I think a very deep investigation into whether other evidence exists, going back and rehashing what witnesses have to say, what your client has to say. It's a time-consuming process, but the time has to be spent investigating exactly what could have potentially gone wrong here and whether or not something was missed.
Well, that is fascinating. It's been a really interesting discussion, an engaging discussion. I'm so excited about this project. And I'm more excited about episode 2, where we're going to continue our journey back to Prince Edward County in the 1880s. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don't forget to check the show notes for your CPD accreditation. And be sure to check in for the second and final episode on the Lazier murder. We'll explore how community unrest impacted the trial and how the effects of social media still plays out in courtrooms today. Let us know what you think. The OBA is on Twitter and so am I. The OBA's handle is @OBALawyers and mine is @CharleneYYZ. You can also email us at pod@OBA.org. That's pod@OBA.org with your thoughts and feedback.